Before I introduce the individual members of the panel, if you'll allow me, what I'd like to do is take a couple of minutes to discuss with you where we are today in Army intelligence interrogations. Army intelligence interrogations are conducted based on Army Field Manual 34-52. This is a 1992 Army Field Manual that continues today to be the baseline guidance, policy, and procedures and techniques that are used for intelligence interrogations. And in fact, this Army Field Manual has been adopted throughout the Department of Defense as the standard for intelligence interrogations. The goal of intelligence interrogations, as stated in the Army Field Manual, is to obtain reliable information in a lawful manner, in a minimum amount of time, and to satisfy intelligence requirements of any echelon of command. Now, international law and the Geneva Convention specifically recognize that interrogations of detained personnel will occur. And the minimum standard of treatment for interrogations under the Geneva Conventions is that of humane treatment. The Army Field Manual 34-52 repeatedly references the requirement for interrogators and for their commanders to ensure that interrogations are conducted in compliance with both domestic and international law. Specifically, 34-52 states, the GWS, the Geneva Wounded and Sick, the GPW, Geneva Prisoners of War, the GC, Geneva Convention for Protection of Civilians, and U.S. policy expressly prohibit acts of violence or intimidation, including physical or mental torture, threats, insults, or exposure to inhumane treatment as a means of or aid to interrogation. Such illegal acts are not authorized and will not be condoned by the U.S. Army. Acts in violation of these prohibitions are criminal acts punishable under the UCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice. If there is doubt as to the legality of a proposed form of interrogation not specifically authorized in this manual, the advice of the command judge advocate should be sought before using the method in question. Now, defining humane treatment is incredibly difficult. And there's no all-inclusive list in domestic or in international law that would satisfy exactly how we might define humane treatment. Instead, there's really a spectrum of treatment that would potentially go from how we would treat an invited guest to lawful interrogation as envisioned under international law, potentially to cruel and inhumane treatment, all the way to torture at the far end of the spectrum. And humane treatment falls somewhere along that spectrum. And the Army Field Manual recognizes that at times it may be difficult to distinguish where the line would be drawn between lawful interrogation activities and unlawful activities. And in attempting to determine if a contemplated approach or technique would be considered unlawful, the Army Field Manual offers these two tests to our interrogators. Given all the surrounding facts and circumstances, would a reasonable person in the place of the person being interrogated believe that his rights, as guaranteed under both international and U.S. law, are being violated or withheld, or will be violated or withheld if he fails to cooperate? The second test that's provided by the Field Manual is, if your contemplated actions were perpetrated by the enemy against U.S. prisoners of war, you would believe such actions violate international or U.S. law. So how do military interrogators know what techniques are lawful? Well, the Army Field Manual provides 14 designated and approved approach techniques that interrogators are specifically trained to employ. And those are the only authorized approach techniques for intelligence interrogations. Why is it that the Army would limit which interrogation techniques might be employed? Well, I've already mentioned to you the manual discusses domestic law, criminal law. It discusses the needs to comply with international law, but we also have found, based on our experience, that we are better able as a military organization to accomplish our military mission within these limited interrogation techniques. And in fact, the field manual goes further on to say, experience indicates that the use of prohibited techniques is not necessary to gain the cooperation of interrogation sources. Use of torture and other illegal methods is a poor technique that yields unreliable results, may damage subsequent collection efforts, and can induce the source to say what he thinks the interrogator wants to hear. Revelation of use of torture by U.S. personnel will bring discredit upon the U.S. and its armed forces while undermining domestic and international support for the war effort. It also may place U.S. and allied personnel in enemy hands at a greater risk of abuse by their captors. Conversely, knowing the enemy has abused U.S. and allied PWs does not justify using methods of interrogation specifically prohibited by the GWS, the GPW, or GC and U.S. policy. Recent world events have made this Army field manual the subject of intense scrutiny by the military, by the Department of Defense, by the American public, and by the Congress. And in fact, on the 5th of October, 2005, the Senate passed by a 90-9 vote legislation approved by Senator John McCain. And in this legislation, it would limit all Department of Defense interrogations to those techniques listed in our Army field manual. It would further prohibit specifically cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of any person in the custody of the United States. 2 weeks ago today, on the 3rd of November, the Department of Defense issued Department of Defense Directive 3115.09, titled Department of Defense Intelligence Interrogations, Detainee Debriefings, and Tactical Questioning. And among other provisions, this DOD directive states that it is DOD policy that all captured or detained personnel shall be treated humanely. As for the Army Field Manual itself, it is in the process of revision and review. It is pending republication as Army Field Manual 2-22.3, and as of this week, its re-release has been temporarily delayed, but it's one that is continuing to be considered and reviewed. Is the Army Field Manual sufficient under domestic and international law? And if not, should it be changed, and how? Perhaps more importantly for the panel we have before you, if it should be changed, by whom should it be changed? Should it be changed by those responsible for Army doctrine, which is the basis for the Army Field Manual? Should it be changed at the policy level by the Department of Defense? Or should it be a change that's made by the Congress? How should humane treatment be defined? And again, perhaps just as importantly, by whom should humane treatment be defined? These are just some of the questions that this panel is here to address for you. Now, with that in the way of background, allow me, if I could, to provide you some ground rules we'll have here. I intend to introduce each of the panel members to you in turn and give them about 10 minutes to provide some opening remarks to you before I open up the floor for your questions. You're going to see from the makeup of this panel that we have with us very distinguished experts in the field of military detentions and interrogations. For that reason, I ask that you keep your questions focused in the area of military detentions and interrogations and the activities of the Department of Defense. Finally, although the issue of renditions is a very important one for us today, and I imagine that there are a number of questions that you all may have regarding the issue of renditions, this panel is not here this afternoon to discuss renditions with you. What I ask for you to do is to keep your questions and your thoughts specifically with regard to renditions and save them for a panel that's scheduled for February, where we will have that specific topic as the basis for discussion. We really like to keep our focus at DOD.
Can we go to that?
Can we attend?
Yes,
we want
to
watch
like to
that.
Go to that.
I made my first ground rule right there. We will see where we end up. All right. Well, with that as introduction, let me begin here with Brian Del Monte. He is the Department of Defense Deputy Director for Policy Development and International Issues in the Office of Detainee Affairs. His responsibilities include the development of DOD-wide detention policy, for the Office of Detainee Affairs, strategic policy planning, and managing international issues pertaining to detention operations in the global war on terrorism. Prior to joining DOD, Mr. Del Monte taught international relations at George Washington University. He's a graduate of the University of Minnesota at Minneapolis and is currently a PhD candidate in political science at GW. Mr. Del Monte.
Thanks. Let me first apologize to the people behind me. My head's on a swivel. I taught for quite a number of years, and so I usually like to look at the people I'm talking to, but I'll have to apologize that I'm not going to be swinging my head around that much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. All of us do. We're glad, quite frankly, we could get a day out of the Pentagon and come down here. These are important issues, and I know that these are issues that you care about, are interested in, and as John F. Kennedy said, there's a Chinese curse which says, may you live in interesting times. Well, clearly, we live today in interesting times. The challenges that we face may seem daunting. We find ourselves as a superpower in a tumultuous world. While processes like globalization and economic integration are bringing us together, groups like Al-Qaeda, international terrorism, separatist movements, failed states, international crime threaten our security and international stability. Unfortunately, on September 11th, the U.S. painfully realized that there are dangerous groups who seek to undermine our security and global peace and stability. Tonight, I'm here to discuss with you two of the challenges that we face in fighting the war on terrorism, the detention of enemy combatants, and how we obtain information from them. My purpose as part of this panel is going to be to introduce some of the broad concepts and issues that others in the panel are going to address in more detail. I think the major did an excellent job at overviewing the interrogation aspect and the field manual. I'm going to supplement that a little bit with the broader policies that DOD has issued and DOD is working on to cover the gamut of how we detain and how we're obtaining information. I am not an attorney. My stock in trade is political science, and thus I don't view these problems through a rigorous legal framework, but others on this panel clearly are going to be able to answer your more detailed legal questions. But I can answer what I believe are the heart of the choices and strategy that we're employing in the war on terror and how we've created this framework. Briefly, let me just cover two things. One, I want to discuss what our policies are, and the second part, I want to discuss where we're going. On 9/11, the president determined that the appropriate framework, because of what Al-Qaeda had done, because of Al-Qaeda's aims, because Al-Qaeda had thrice declared war on us, that the appropriate framework was the law of war. Those that are detained by the United States at Guantanamo, in Afghanistan, are enemy combatants in the war on terror. That is the framework in which we look at this. In terms of how those individuals are supposed to be treated, I'm sure everyone in this room is familiar with the various opinions that came down from the Justice Department and those edicts of the President that said the conventions will be such that people are going to be treated humanely, but they are not going to be prisoners of war. And this created a unique challenge policy-wise as to how we were going to do that. And we have developed policies in Guantanamo and elsewhere so that individuals are treated humanely. As a practical matter, that means they are provided adequate food, water, shelter, clothing. I can talk later as to some of the other things we do in terms of providing them culturally appropriate meals, in terms of observing religious practices. We go to great lengths to recognize these things at Guantanamo and elsewhere. I realize that's not reported much in the press, but it is the case. The war on terrorism has progressed now for 4 years. We set up Gitmo in 2002. Right? 2002? X-ray? Right? And over those 4 years, we have learned considerably about detention operations. Unfortunately, we had Abu Ghraib, which revealed that even despite a commitment to the law of war and despite our values, that there will be people who will make mistakes and people who will intentionally violate our policies and procedures. If there is a silver lining to Abu Ghraib, it sparked the department to do what I believe is probably one of the most transparent and comprehensive reviews about how we conduct detention. There were over 12 major reviews of detention operations on every aspect of what we do. Policy, operations, interrogation, treatment, you name it, we studied it. So in going forward, the two things that we're focusing on with the Directive 31-1509 and with the directive that I'm intimately working on, the DOD directive on the detainee program, DOD 2310, which I'm sure some of you may have heard because it's mentioned in the paper. The purpose for those documents is to do two things. Incorporate the lessons we have learned from these investigations and to incorporate the lessons we've learned in GWAT. The reality is that the Geneva Conventions apply. The Geneva Conventions have value. But they, in GWAT, they were not in and of themselves providing the full framework for policy development. In looking at 2310, DOD Directive 2310, and looking at the field manual, and looking at all this underlying guidance, our purpose is to develop something which will be durable, which will durable both in terms of, if you will, policy sufficiency and political durability. And secondly, to develop something that will allow us the flexibility we need in facing the enemies that we face. I know that you're all anxious to get to questions, but I just wanted to provide that brief overview for you. And I know that, you know, to the extent you have questions about policy, I am here to answer them.
Thank you, sir. Charles Allen joins us from the General Counsel's Office of the Department of Defense as Deputy General Counsel for International Affairs, and he's held that position since May of 2000. He is responsible for providing legal services and advice on DOD's wide range of international issues and supervises a staff of 14 attorneys. His area of responsibility includes legal advice on DOD planning and conduct of military operations in the war on terrorism and the war in Iraq, including law of armed conflict and war crimes issues. Mr. Allen was a judge advocate in the U.S. Navy and served as deputy legal advisor to the National Security Council from 1998 to 2000. He is a graduate of Stanford University, the University of Georgia Law School, and George Washington Law School, where he received an LLM in International and Comparative Law. Mr. Allen.
Thank you very much, Gretchen. And thank you for your introduction. I thought that was a very good scene setter for us today. As always, we in the Pentagon are happy to be in Charlottesville. I wish we could stay a little bit longer. We have to go back to the grind and be back for tomorrow morning. But also, I'm really happy to be here, not only with old friends like Scott, but particularly for myself with my colleagues from DOD. And sort of, I'm not alone here. Not only is Brian here from the policy side, but my friend and colleague Diane Beaver, who's a retired Army judge advocate and is kind of the mainstay in our office on detainee matters. So I hope you'll forgive me if I sort of deflect questions to them. We're here earnestly to try to explain and deal with these issues as we've been asked to do, and I appreciate that opportunity. We certainly don't have all the answers, and I just know that we're going to go away with ideas that maybe we haven't thought of before, and that will help us in our work. Brian talked a little bit about the war on terrorism, and I would say at the outset that throughout this conflict, we've been looking to applicable law. It's the U.S. Constitution, U.S. statutes, treaty obligations, and particularly the law of war to frame our actions. The president, as commander in chief, took action to defend the country and to prevent additional attacks after 9/11. The Congress, of course, stepped in, as did, of course, most importantly, the Congress, but everyone knows that NATO stepped in, the UN Security Council stepped in right away, and recognize the severity of the situation. And Congress, on September 18, 2001, supported the President's use of all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks or harbored such organizations or persons. That continues as the law of the land. Congress also emphasized that the forces responsible for the 9/11 attacks pose an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, and the President has the authority under the Constitution to take action to deter and prevent acts of international terrorism against the United States. Under that authority, we're now, you know, more than 4 years into this, U.S. and coalition forces removed the Taliban from power, eliminated that primary source of support to the terrorists who attacked our nation on 9/11, and seriously degraded Al-Qaeda's training capability, among other things. In the conduct of these operations, the U.S. Armed Forces, consistent with the law and settled practice during armed conflict, have seized many hostile persons and detained, sometimes people forget, really only a small fraction of those that we initially detained in any combat action. It's way, way into the thousands initially have been detained, and we're in the hundreds of people who continue to be detained in this conflict. On February 7, 2002, the President determined that the Third Geneva Convention applies to the Taliban detainees, but not to Al-Qaeda detainees, because Afghanistan is a party to the Geneva Conventions, but Al-Qaeda, an international terrorist group, is not, of course. He also determined that under Article 4 of that Third Geneva Convention, Taliban detainees are not entitled to POW status. Even so, he directed the United States Armed Forces to treat detainees humanely. Gretchen started with that. Brian has mentioned that. I'll mention that. And there's no deviation from that standard. This doesn't mean that just because they didn't have POW status that they did not have protections under the law of war. In fact, it's not often commented upon, but the President's military order of November 13, 2001 specifically provides the detainees shall be treated humanely without any adverse distinction based on race, color, religion, gender, birth, wealth, or any similar criteria. Words that you'll find in common Article 3 as well as other treaty provisions under the law of war, afforded adequate food and so forth. As Brian alluded to, there are culturally appropriate meals. Ramadan just ended early in November. The Guantanamo staff served meals at pre-dawn and midnight, helped detainees observe their customs during this holy period. We were commenting in the car on the way here. It's too bad that more people can't go to Guantanamo. Brian was telling me about the kitchen staff and the great lengths that they go to provide the kinds of service and to ensure that kind of treatment, as well as, of course, the world-class medical treatment that is available to them. A little bit about the concept of enemy combatants in armed conflict. Those who are members of Al-Qaeda, Taliban, or their affiliates and supporters are enemy combatants who may be detained for the duration of hostilities. Like any war, it's not exactly clear when this war is going to end. It gives us a particular problem because, I suppose if it were a war between nations, you could say, well, gosh, this can't go on for too many years. With this war, I don't think people really have their arms around how long it might last, and that poses significant problems. This definition of being detained under the laws and customs of war to the end of hostilities gives the flexibility to address the specific circumstances of any given conflict. The Deputy Secretary of Defense, in his order establishing the Combatant Status Review Tribunal, defined an enemy combatant for purposes of the war on terrorism as an individual who was part of or supporting Taliban or Al-Qaeda forces or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition forces. The Supreme Court in June 2004 stated that for the purpose of this particular case, which was the Hamdi case, an enemy combatant is an individual who was part of or supporting forces hostile to the U.S. or coalition partners in Afghanistan and who engaged in armed conflict against the U.S. So I think that that basic principle has been confirmed. The concept of when it ends is when there's no reasonable prospect of resumption of hostilities. It's sometimes overlooked part of Justice O'Connor's opinion in the Hamdi case was that she wrote that the capture and detention of enemy combatants, including even U.S. citizens, until the end of hostilities are important incidents of war whose purpose serves to prevent captured combatants from returning to the battlefield and taking up arms. The military's authority to capture and detain enemy combatants, I submit, is well established and time-honored. Those combatant status review tribunals, I guess if I were to be completely frank about it, would have been perhaps good if we had done that before the Supreme Court ruled. They're obviously a response to the decision that the Supreme Court made, and that has been a criticism I recall when Mr. Taft was here in the spring speaking. His view was, let's try to anticipate what the next thing is that the Supreme Court might rule on and see if we can address that before the fact. But I stand by the Combatant Status Review Tribunal process as a superb way far beyond any existing procedure in doctrine or a practice of any nation at any time in history in armed conflict. Those tribunals, all of which have been completed, determined whether in fact the persons detained continued to be regarded properly as enemy combatants. They were tribunals that actually followed similar procedures to those in an Army regulation 190-8 that dates back before 9/11 that the court referred to in its decision. They're comprised of three neutral commissioned officers, a non-voting officer as a recorder, decisions by a preponderance of the evidence. Detainee has rights to call reasonably available witnesses, question witnesses, testify, or address the tribunal in other ways, not be compelled to testify, and to attend the open portion of the proceeding. As of the springtime, the CSRT director had taken action on all 558 cases. 38 detainees were determined no longer to be enemy combatants. 28 of them have been returned to their home countries and arrangements made for getting the release of the others. Some of those others are people who wouldn't want to go back to their countries if they could. Chinese Uyghurs, for example. And we're trying very hard to find places that will receive them. And I'd like to submit that underscores our commitment to their humane treatment. We are not going to return them to places where they may be tortured. Administrative review boards on top of the CSRTs provides an at least annual further review of whether detainees should continue to be detained. Since the early days of having detainees, I can still hear Secretary Rumsfeld's words, we just don't want to keep these people any longer than is absolutely necessary. And these boards are the way that we are able to ensure that we are that if there are appropriate cases where people can be returned to their countries, that we will do so. The Administrative Review Board processes similarly have a full and fair process for that determination. We are getting close to the end of that whole process, which has been really a difficult one. And through that process, there have been, recommendations of 179 to be released, and 68 have been transferred to 15 different countries. I might just point out that the last one who was released to Egypt, and there was press about this. How could you release somebody to Egypt? As it turned out, we did receive the assurances. I don't want to do a sidebar on the bureaucracy, but it was really hard to get the appropriate assurances. And I, aside from the cynical point of how hard it is to do things in bureaucracies, the good point is that we worked really hard with our State Department colleagues, our post in Egypt, to make sure that we had the kind of assurances that would stand up. This detainee was released in Egypt, and we have confirmation that in fact he was not abused. This is a person who, I guess, went to the press and said that he was injured by guards. We happen to know, and this has been publicized, he was in an auto accident before he was detained. We offered him the treatment that he needed to be made well with the U.S. Quality surgery. He refused all of that, but in any event, that's the last case of a release. In terms of access to U.S. courts, there are habeas cases that are, you know, continue to be under consideration by the courts following the Supreme Court's decisions. We're, you know, dealing with those, and I think there are about 170 of them at this 170 cases covering 260 detainees at this juncture. Regarding interrogations, I think that Gretchen really laid it out well. Obviously, it's the policy of the U.S. to comply with all of its legal obligations in treatment, including in terms of interrogations. We have the Convention Against Torture, to which we are a party. There is the implementing statute under 18 U.S.C. 2340 enacted to fulfill our obligations under the Convention Against Torture. We have, you know, really solid guidance. I'd point to a point that Brian made about the transparency that has occurred in the last year and a half or so, including the fact that our the seminal interpretation of the statute for purposes of these detainees, an Office of Legal Counsel opinion of December 30, 2004, has been made public. Obviously, we take all of these matters seriously, and again, I think Gretchen pointed out that these legal requirements under the Convention Against Torture, fundamentally under the law of war, the principles of the Geneva Conventions, and the anti-torture statute, and most important of all, perhaps, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, are all embodied in the field manual, and now. Certainly are confirmed by the new DOD directive on interrogations. Signed earlier this month, it actually puts a little twist into the field manual because it requires that manual, before it is finalized in its new iteration, go to the Undersecretary for Intelligence for review, and that review continues as we speak. I think it was in the paper today that there, speculation as to the delay. One of the matters that is at issue is that it became obvious that now that it's very close to being concluded, we need to make sure that the combatant commanders with responsibility to the Secretary and the President throughout the world need to see this and have at least a brief opportunity before we go final with that manual. The directive on intelligence interrogations is not necessarily new in every respect, but it's nice in that it consolidates a number of different policies and ensures that all of the components have it in one place with clarity, which isn't always the case in government work. The best we can, I think it's a pretty good product. The field manual should be out soon. I think that the new version will have nothing particularly new with regard to approaches, but it has more references of the likes of which Gretchen spoke relating to applicable legal requirements. I think there are some nice things in there about, this is a manual for interrogators. I've been, constantly chided as I've, suggested rewording things. Look, this isn't a legal matter. It's, we're instructing, we're providing the rules and the instruction under which people will conduct interrogations. You've got to keep it at an operational level. And in doing so, there's some very good devices in there in terms of, think about it to interrogate. Think about it this way. What would you think if that were done to our forces? Lots of different ways of getting at doing the right thing within the parameters of humane treatment. I can touch on some other things maybe in questions on, for example, our medical policy, what we've done with regard to hunger strikers in Guantanamo. But let me just close by saying that you know, clearly we've been challenged in the legal community within the Department of Defense in the war on terrorism. I'm proud of my colleagues, the civilian and military, particularly the uniformed judge advocates have done in these years. Some have lost their lives in combat and been seriously injured. But I think their efforts and their you know, their really persistence in doing the right thing and abiding by the law and importantly advising command on the law has constituted an excellent record. And I just think they're invaluable, and I think the secretary and the secretaries of the military departments understand this and really respect what they're doing. There's been a lot of uncertainty. We're still grappling with it, and I'll come right back to what I said at the beginning. Our minds are open. If there are things that we haven't thought of before, we'd like to hear your ideas. There are just a lot of complex matters that still need to be thought about by the best and brightest, and we're open to good ideas. I do think, however, that in this war and on into the future, established principles of the law of war have served us well. They've had to be looked at, and just like in the sense of enemy combatants, how that varies from the classic POW situation of the uniformed forces of our enemy, which has been the case throughout our history. That's not the case with Al-Qaeda. We have to see how those principles are applied there. But I believe that the existing law of armed conflict, and particularly those principles, provide the right foundation for meeting these challenges. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Mark Garlasco is the senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch. He is Human Rights Watch's resident expert on battle damage assessment, military operations, and interrogations. Before moving to Human Rights Watch, Mr. Garlasco spent 7 years in the Pentagon as a senior intelligence analyst covering Iraq. Most recently, Mr. Garlasco authored a report based on information provided by Captain Ian Fishback and other soldiers titled Leadership Failure, First-Hand Accounts of Torture of Iraqi Detainees by the U.S. Army's 82nd Airborne Division. Mr. Garlasco is a graduate of St. John's University and received his master's in international relations from George Washington University.
Thanks very much. As a token liberal here, I think it's really stunning that I would be the one with a PowerPoint presentation. But I have to tell you, after serving almost 7 years on the joint staff, it's very difficult to get away from that. I also want to thank...
No, it's not.
I want to thank the panelists, because at least for me, this is really like an all-star game here. I'm sure Mr. Allen doesn't remember, but there was a time when I actually briefed you, sir, as well as Mr. Haynes, back in the day, as a young analyst. At any rate, I do recognize that PowerPoint is a violation of the Geneva Convention. And I just wanted to put that forward to you all. But I want to let you know about my very first... I put a lot of effort into that. I want to let you know, before I get into the meat here, about the first time I really came into contact with FM-34-52. It was in the year 2001. I was in a Middle Eastern country as a senior intelligence officer working with an army interrogator. And we were in a hotel speaking with a defector from Iraq. And we also had a local with us from a local intelligence service of that foreign nation. And as we were speaking to the individual, it became apparent to us that he was lying. The information that he was providing was false, and we were very frustrated with it. At that point, the local security individual turned to us, and he said very succinctly, "You want me to break his fingers?" In a split moment, I thought to myself, you know, just that split moment. One, oh my God, what am I going to do if he's serious? And I think he was. And two, you know, I am awfully frustrated with this guy. But that's probably not the right answer. But the interrogator immediately looked at him and said, "That's illegal. We're not doing that." that's not the right thing to do. And pulled him aside, and we had a come to Jesus moment where we explained to him that, you know, it doesn't work, that using force doesn't work. I'd like to say, you know, first of all, you know, from Human Rights Watch, our perspective is that the interrogation manual actually is a pretty good document. We like it a lot. As it stands, it's practical, beyond being just a legal document. It gives, you know, some guidelines. It gives the interrogators guidelines on what they can do and what they can't do. And we certainly appreciate the explicit prohibition against the use of force. And so, in essence, it is a good document. As all legal documents, we recognize it does evolve, however. And we appreciate that now the Army and the Judge Advocate General Warren and all the other lawyers are looking at doing that. Oh, by the way, I'm not a lawyer, but just want to let you know that. Just to quickly go through this, I know everyone has seen this before, but just I want to make one point. You know, we take a look at how things moved, and at least how we at HRW feel that things kind of progressed from Guantanamo Bay and not allowing folks to have POW protections, and how that migrated. And, you know, the torture memo that came out really was at odds with the military commanders. And just to quote Air Force Major General Reeves, he wrote in response to the, you know, quote-unquote torture memo of August 2002, that the use of the more extreme interrogation techniques simply is not how the U.S. Armed Forces have operated in recent history. We have taken the legal and moral high road in the conduct of our military operations, regardless of how others may operate. Our forces are trained in this legal and moral mindset beginning the day they enter active duty. And we at Human Rights Watch, we see that every day, and you know, we completely concur and understand. The problem is some of the policy decisions that have been made seem to have moved us away from that and have confused things. Particularly for myself, that was apparent when I met with Captain Fishback and the two sergeants that are in the report. And on the 5th of October, when the Senate voted 90-9 to pass the McCain Amendment, I was actually in Senator McCain's office with Captain Fishback and in Senator Warner's office with him. And we had some really positive discussions with the senators. So the question is, do we need a statute? Now, we believe the manual, whether it's this one or the new and revised one, provides solid rules and guidelines. But we have seen a failure to assure that the U.S. abides by its legal obligations as far as the slippery slope towards torture has gone. Further, and I know we're not going to go into it, but, you know, the loopholes for, you know, quote-unquote OGA are of great concern to us. Another issue that we have is that whenever there is a violation, we've seen a real problem with accountability. NJP, non-judicial punishment, is really a norm. You know, while you look at many of the cases that have been adjudicated, a slap on the wrist is something that most of the troops are getting. Additionally, we have problems with the ability of a commander to basically push aside recommendations by CID investigators and not move to a court-martial. And lastly, you know, there have been 86 detainee deaths in custody. Now, you know, obviously people die of a variety of reasons, and that's the way it goes. But of those, there have been numerous homicides, and yet we've not seen any trials for homicide. It's always for a lesser case. Now, torture and CID, obviously, as we've stated, it's not a gray area. A variety of laws, Geneva Convention, customary international law, UCMJ, CAT, War Crimes Act, federal anti-torture status. So it's well established. And CID is as prohibited as torture is. Now, we recognize, you know, you don't have to put the guys up at the Ritz. We don't, and we appreciate that they're getting good food. You know, you really don't have to do that. I'm sure that they appreciate it. But, you know, we recognize that you don't have to go out of your way to be nice to these fellows. You know, I have friends of mine from my previous life who have been working at Guantanamo Bay for some time. And I take it to heart when they tell me, you know, some of these guys really don't belong here and need to be sent back home. But you know, there are a lot of them that the day we let them free, they're just going to look for an excuse to go and kill Americans. And I take that to heart. Some things are fine for periods of time or for limited use, but it's really difficult to respect the limits. You know, if you're going to have someone stand for a period, or if you're going to do other things for a short period, you know, they may be fine. It's when you get into extended issues or mixing them up. And finally, there are some things that are completely unacceptable, such as waterboarding. And Senator McCain has touched on that. And basically the point is, if you follow the field manual, you're never even going to get to the line, let alone cross the line. Just quickly, some tangential issues that we have concerns with. We certainly accept the need for a classified annex to the new manual, particularly since we do not want to allow people to know specific interrogation methods so that they then can develop countermeasures to them. We accept that. However, we just have concerns that any exceptions, little loopholes would lead to big ones. And so it's something that we're concerned with. Many of the soldiers who have come to Human Rights Watch have complained to us that as combat soldiers, being guarding prisoners is something that they should not be asked to do. I don't know that we agree with them so much. You know, if that's your job, that's your job. If you're a soldier and you've got to watch over someone you've captured, that's the way it is. I think the problem really comes down to leadership and training, and with it, they really can overcome these issues. We are hearing more point of capture problems. That's certainly coming to us on a renewed basis. We have concerns with the use of MPs as interrogators, the outsourcing of torture, and the current habeas issues that are being looked at. You know, this is an area where we feel that military and humanitarian issues coincide. The military doesn't want to torture, we realize that. And we certainly want to make sure that prisoners and detainees are treated humanely. But one of the core issues here is future use and reciprocity. Now, I'm not going to stand here and try to say to you that Al-Qaeda is going to provide reciprocity. I'm not that naive. But someday in the future, it's certainly very possible, if not likely, that the United States military will get into a war with another nation, and it will be important that we have followed the Geneva Conventions so that the troops that are captured in the future, American soldiers, are treated in the same manner. And lastly, just to look at that golden rule again. You know, if a soldier asks himself, if I was treated like this, would I think it's illegal? And, you know, I've had soldiers say to me, well, you know something, I've been to SEER school, and I've been treated a heck of a lot harsher than some of the things we do. And so I just say to them, now, would you want your troops treated like this? And I think that's the final question we would put to them. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Barlasco. Our final panelist is Scott Stuckey. Mr. Stuckey is the General Counsel of the Senate Armed Services Committee and has served in that position since 1996, except for the period of Democratic control of the Senate from 2001 to 2003. In his present capacity, he's responsible for all legal matters for the committee majority. Prior to taking his current general counsel position, Mr. Stuckey served as the chief of the legislative branch, General Law Division, Office of the Judge Advocate General for the United States Air Force. Mr. Stuckey spent 5 years on active duty as an Air Force Judge Advocate and later retired from the Air Force Reserve as a colonel. Mr. Stuckey is a graduate of Wichita State University and Harvard Law School. He holds a master's in history from Trinity University and an LLM in international law from George Washington University. Mr. Stuckey.
I'm going to talk about recent legislative developments in these areas, and I will preface it with a question to the audience. How many of you know the difference between authorizing and appropriating legislation? I didn't think so. Okay, I better explain it, because I'm going to be talking about these things. Every year, Congress passes for the Department of Defense an authorization bill, which comes out of the Committees on Armed Services. Those are the committees having legislative jurisdiction over DOD and the armed forces. It also passes an appropriations bill, which comes out of the Committees on Appropriations. Authorization bills are the repositories for substantive legislation. Appropriations bills are what places where you divvy up money. Authorization bills authorize expenditures. Appropriations bills actually give you the money. But the authorizing process is the process that is normally used for substantive legislation governing matters within the legislative jurisdiction of a particular committee. And so I'm going to be talking primarily about the Defense Authorization Bill as just passed by the Senate, and I will allude to the Appropriations Bill that was passed earlier this month. There have been several mentions of a 90-9 vote. That was on the Appropriations Bill, which is now in conference. Okay. We just passed on the Senate floor the annual FY2006 DOD Authorization Bill. What's in there? The first thing that's in there is Senator McCain's two amendments, which also went in the Appropriations Bill. These are, one, uniform standards for interrogation, and two, a prohibition on torture and cruel and inhuman treatment. Now, the uniform standards piece, and this was alluded to earlier, is a curious piece of statutory drafting because it incorporates by reference an Army field manual, which is itself an administrative document that can be changed by the Secretary of the Army. Normally, you don't do that in statutory drafting. You don't incorporate something that can be administratively changed. Senator McCain determined to do that, and that's the way it came out, and that's the way it's in both the Appropriations Bill and the Authorizing Bill. But it's a curious way to get into a statutory prohibition. The second one, and it that only applies to DOD. Number two is the prohibition on torture and inhuman cruel treatment. That applies across the board. It is not limited to DOD. Okay. Those are the McCain amendments. They are in the authorization bill. They are in the appropriation bill. I will come to what may happen next in a minute. On the authorization process, they were adopted by a voice vote. They weren't even voted with a record vote. They were adopted 90-9 in the appropriations process. Okay. The second thing that's in the authorization bill, and this is not in the appropriations bill, at least not in the same form, is the Graham Amendment. This is Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. The Graham Amendment does two things. Number one, it requires submission of the CSRT ARB regs to Congress and congressional review of them. That part of it is in the appropriations bill. The part that is not in the appropriations bill is the part dealing with habeas corpus review of detainee petitions. The Graham Amendment amends 28 U.S.C. 2241, which is the federal habeas statute, to divest courts, federal courts, justices, and judges of jurisdiction over habeas corpus petitions from persons detained by the Department of Defense at Guantanamo Bay. And I'll talk about the reasons for these limitations and the way it was drafted in a minute. It substitutes for habeas review a limited form of direct review in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. That is limited to, one, the question of whether the designated civilian official, who is the at the moment, the Secretary of the Navy, who is the person who makes the final determinations on combatant status for people at Gitmo, whether the department, whether the DCO followed the procedures set out for CSRTs issued by the department. And two, whether the individual's detention is consistent with the Constitution and federal law. Now, the other thing that the Graham Amendment does is apply this same form of review to the military commissions, which are the trial courts set up to try detainees for violations of the law of war, and which have not so far tried anyone. The President's military order of November 2001 did not provide, in fact prohibited, direct judicial review of the decisions of military commissions. It instead substituted an appellate panel made up of three distinguished Americans, actually four distinguished Americans, which has so far not convened because it's had nothing to review. The Graham Amendment would provide the same sort of limited direct review in the D.C. Circuit for the final decisions of military commissions that it provides for detainee petitions. It's an interesting thing because the President specifically precluded this in his order, and one could argue, and I've seen it argued, that you could have a situation like occurred at the beginning of the Civil War, when President Lincoln suspended habeas corpus unilaterally by executive fiat, and a secessionist named Merriman in Maryland, which was covered by the Lincoln's order, was clapped into the stockade and petitioned for habeas. Chief Justice Taney on circuit issued an order to show cause why the writ should not be granted. The marshal attempted to serve the writ at the stockade. The commander refused to take it, and Merriman stayed in jail. I doubt that we'll have that situation here. I think it's clearly within the constitutional power of Congress to define and punish offenses against the law of nations, to regulate and provide review of the military commissions. But that's also in there. The habeas stuff, both with regard to the CSRTs and with regard to the commissions, should any ever be convened, is in the authorization bill alone. Now, this passed the Senate 84-14 after an amendment by Senator Bingaman of New Mexico was rejected. Bingaman's amendment would have retained habeas review, but trimmed it slightly, doing away with, among other things, controversies asking for monetary damages. That lost 58-40. Once that was disposed of, the Senate voted overwhelmingly in favor of the Graham Compromise. Basically, the 14 opponents were three parties: very liberal Democrats, who didn't like messing with habeas at all; very conservative Republicans, who didn't like messing with anything at all; and Senator Specter, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, who didn't like it because it should have been in his committee. After all, judiciary's got jurisdiction over habeas corpus, no doubt about that. But 84 senators voted for it. Senator Graham had to, you've all heard about squaring the circle, it's a mathematical impossibility. Well, Senator Graham had to square the political circle to do this. He had two co-sponsors for this amendment: Carl Levin, the ranking Democrat on the Committee on Armed Services, who by any standards is a thoroughgoing liberal Democrat, and John Kyle from Arizona, who by any standards is a thoroughgoing conservative Republican. He had these two guys on board. He got the votes of people like Senator Clinton, Senator Schumer, for this amendment. He also got the White House on board after a great deal of agonizing dickering, which I wasn't party to, but I was informed about. So he really did that. It was quite a political feat. Finally, he had to shave the amendment so that it would fit within the contours of the unanimous consent agreement governing consideration of the bill, which said that all amendments had to be either relevant to the underlying bill or within the jurisdiction of the Armed Services Committee. Well, habeas corpus ain't within the jurisdiction of the Armed Services Committee, so he had to render it relevant. He had to find a hook in the underlying bill and make it relevant, and after some twisting and turning, he got the parliamentarian to agree that it was relevant. That's why it's limited to Gitmo. It didn't start out that way, but that's why it's limited to Gitmo, because there's stuff on Gitmo detainees in the underlying bill, and that rendered it relevant, and he had to do that as a matter of parliamentary procedure to get it considered. So, he managed to square the circle and get that in the bill. Okay, it's in there. Now what? The bill goes to conference with the House, which has no such provisions in its version. I'm talking about the authorization bill now. The McCain amendments, as I said earlier, are also in the DOD appropriations bill, which has already gone to conference. The Speaker of the House has thus far refused to appoint conferees on the part of the House to the appropriations bill because the Speaker fears a motion to instruct conferees over there that would pass overwhelmingly. Basically, what the House leadership is afraid of is that there will be a motion to instruct the House conferees on the appropriations bill to recede, in other words, to give in to the Senate on the detainee amendments. In other words, to take the detainee amendments. Now, such motions, such votes are not binding on the conferees because we've had the House do it on stuff in our bill that ended up getting pitched out anyway. But they are a substantial expression of House opinion. And so far, the Speaker has not allowed them to do that. And we're running out of money, and we're going to have a continuing resolution to keep the armed forces going because there isn't an appropriations bill. Okay. I think the same thing is likely to happen in the authorization conference. We have appointed Senate conferees on the authorization bill. The House has not yet appointed conferees. For the House, it's a very complex process because their own internal rules require them to appoint not just members of the House Armed Services Committee, but members of other committees with jurisdiction over bits and pieces of the bill. So there will be House outside conferees from House Judiciary to consider the habeas corpus provision. And that always takes a couple of weeks because there's all kinds of jockeying and dickering over there as to who gets to be a conferee. My guess is that the Speaker will not let them appoint conferees, at least not initially. We will go ahead and conference the bill informally, and when we finally get to the point where we've got a conference report and they've got to pull the trigger, they're going to pull the trigger. What will happen in conference? I long ago learned never to predict what happens in conference. Conference is an animal that takes on a life of its own. And when you're down to the last day or two and you're trying to get stuff done, all kinds of precious stuff suddenly doesn't seem as precious and gets thrown over the side. I predict, and this is purely for internal consumption here, I predict that the McCain amendments will not make it through conference in the appropriations process. I predict that in the end, to get an appropriations bill, they'll pitch them over the side. The authorization conference, another thing. They ought to be considered in the authorization conference because that's where they belong. They don't belong on appropriations legislation. And what will happen there, I wouldn't even venture to guess. So that's where we are at the moment. We're jumping into conference 3 months late with a lot of pressure to get it done, but I doubt that we will get it done before the end of January. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stuckey. Before we open it up to questions from the audience, I'd like to offer an opportunity to the panelists, if any of you would like to respond very briefly to any of the comments in the opening remarks of the other panel members. Now would be an opportunity to do that. No takers.
I know. I think.
Do
you?
Well, I could just comment. I think even today there were some charges brought against soldiers who had some responsibility, allegedly, for some deaths in Bagram of detainees. Mr. Golasco mentioned, certainly doesn't address his entire point about accountability. I think I would claim that a great deal has been done to hold people accountable. There are different levels of accountability, including courts-martial and other forms of punishment under the UCMJ, as well as administrative measures. And again, cases were brought just today against some people.